I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business. Hey, gang, so you know our show here is sponsored by the wonderful 750, which is a search and find pricing database for wholesale buyers in New York and New Jersey, which we love very much. But we found a few other people who love it, too, one of whom is the fabulous Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, who's here today.
Hey guys, so I buy for a lot of different random wines, and I love to use 750 because there's a lot of great smaller wholesalers on there that you can take a look at. And as Garth Algar would say from Wayne's World, live in the now, use 750 because it's great. And it's wonderful for those liquor buyers and wine buyers out there.
Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, a user of the 750 service. Thank you. Ralph Kutl of Trestle on 10th on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good. How about you?
Nice to see you.
Likewise. It's a cool day today, but yeah.
So you're actually our first chef guest on the show. Usually we do sommeliers, wine directors, importers, retailers, writers. But you're a chef who also buys the wine for his restaurant, which is something you don't see that much of anymore. Maybe we could talk about how you got started as a chef. You were in Switzerland?
Yeah. Grew up in Switzerland. My dad was a game warden, mom was a homemaker, and always liked cooking, always been around food, always been around farmers. And then when I was 15 and a half, I started an apprenticeship about 30 miles, 40 miles away from home on Lake of Zurich. Did that for 3-4 years, worked in several places in Switzerland, Lausanne, Arosa, Zurich. Then came to the United States at the tender age of 24.
So your dad used to buy a little wine for the house?
Yes. We always had a flagon, 50-liter flagon of what I suspect was Merlot at home from the Ticino, Italian-speaking part of Switzerland.
Oh, okay, all the way down at the bottom.
Yeah, yeah. So the big semi would come by every few months, drop one of those off and carry off the empty one. And it was my job to siphon off the red wine into clean bottles, then cook the corks, hammer them in, and bring the bottles down into the cellar. We always had wine around, or beer.
And this was like when you were 15?
Well, much younger, when I was 8, 8 to 15, and then they kept on doing it. But yeah, lots of wine around.
So you were kind of like cleaning the bottles and taking the corks out and reusing the corks and kind of a homegrown style.
Yes, with one of those fangled Italian corkscrews with the two prongs. And you actually use those so you don't destroy the cork and you don't dig a hole in it so you can reuse the corks, and you boil the corks for a half an hour so they're nice and soft since we didn't have a cork press. Then you pop them back into the bottle.
And you ended up going as an apprentice.
Yeah, that's something that you do unless you choose an academic career. You start your apprenticeship around 15, 16 years old, which I did for 3 years. It was quite fun. First time away from home. You know, I grew up, like I said, quite bucolic surroundings in the middle of nowhere in Switzerland in the hills. Lots of cows. Then being away the first time was quite exciting. You know, 15, you're still a kid and you run around with other apprentices and do mischief and... Yeah, we had a good time. We had a good time.
And you started butchering and that kind of
stuff?
That's
all part of the whole program. I spend 4 days a week at the restaurant. One day was school and then 2 days off, except in a season when we only had 1 day off. So 5 months four months out of a year, we only get, you know, a little bit less off. We did everything from butchering, small pigs, deer, breaking down fishes, halibut, turbo, you know, you name it, we just got it. And then, of course, the cooking part, learn it all.
And it was a Swiss style of cuisine.
Yeah, it's Swiss cuisine, but, of course, the fundamentals are all based in French cuisine. That's what we learn, and all the... You know, the 16,000 different sauces and different cuts of potatoes and all the stuff that nobody cares about it today anymore, although I wish they would a little bit. because it does give you a great foundation for cooking. You know?
Were you really focused on moving in a direction of cooking at that time, or was it more something that was arranged?
No, we really never talked about different cuisines. It was just French cuisine that was around. And then, of course, in the 80s, we had Nouvelle Cuisine, Marco Pierre White. You know, we all worshipped him. He was God. And we thought, wow, you know, cool guy, rock star, you know, what is he doing? And today, of course, you look at that stuff and it's all very dated. But that's what we try to do.
Were you really focused as a young man at that time on cooking, or more, I mean, what did someone take you under their wing, or was it more the situation you found yourself in?
Well, I found myself in a situation. I always liked to cook or be around food when I grew up before, you know, when I started my apprenticeship. But the attitude was a little different at that time. For example, my entire family said, you know, you're never going to get hungry if you're a cook. So that was, and even my grandfather, great-grandfather, they all said, we are never going to get hungry if you're a cook. That was foremost on their mind. That's what they were concerned. And
because of poverty and people starve sometimes. In reality.
Yeah. Having a job was much more important than being in love with your job. And today everybody talks about the passion. That was not part of the conversation, that was not part of the vocabulary, passion and loving what you do and all that. Of course, looking back now, and I just mentioned Marco Pierre White, we weren't aware of that he was only able to do that groundbreaking re-engineering of old French cuisine without that passion, but it was never explained to us. Passion came then later on when I worked under Michael Romano at Union Square Cafe. That was the first time where I felt like, wow, this guy loves what he's doing, and how can I soak that up and how can I be part of that, because it is cool to love what you do. It's not just means to an end.
And in the meantime, you were working in other parts of Switzerland for a bit?
Yeah, I worked up in Arosa in the mountains, worked in Lausanne, French-speaking part, for 1.5 years. But a year before that, my dad passed away, so I missed home and I missed my friends and want to be back home again. So I worked in Zurich, at Agnes Zamberg, which was a one-star Michelin restaurant, very successful. And that was the first time where I then got in contact with serious wine people. Sadly, I didn't take up on the opportunity to pursue that. I didn't know what I had. But that's when the first time I really realized that, wow, there's a wine world out there. And together with the food of Agnes Zamberg, which was Nouvelle Cuisine, but with lots of local ingredients, pretty much what we do today here in New York, trying to find, you know, the closest local ingredients, instead of having, you know, something shipped in from South America in December. However, worked in Zurich, and at that point I figured, okay, had enough of this. I want to see something else. So I send out applications and resumes to prominent restaurants and hotels, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, and I figured the first place that writes me back and sponsors a visa, that's where I'm going to go to. And sure enough, it ended up being a Swiss restaurant up in New Milford, Connecticut. You know, but the owner of that restaurant sponsored me, got me a J-1 visa, and off I went.
So it was your first time in America?
Yeah.
And what was that like? Did you like it right away?
It was awesome. We had, you know, 2 days off, well, 2.5 days off. I had my own car, Chevrolet Caprice diesel. It was awesome. It was the end of the big car era. I'm pretty happy I experienced that. So I went up to Provincetown. I went up to Vermont. Went down during vacation time to Florida, Texas, Colorado, and I'm back in 3 weeks with my then girlfriend. It was fun. I had a good time. I did that for a year. Because the visa ran out, I went back to Switzerland and then pretty quickly decided that I wanted to come back because it was such a great experience. I love this country. And ended up in New York at Union Square Cafe.
And how was that working at that time? I mean, who was there with you besides Michael? Were there other people working on the line that later became...
One of the sous chefs, Jamie Leeds. She's now down in D.C., very successful, has 2-3 restaurants. It was Claudia Fleming. She was in the pastry apartment. She still pursued dancing at that time and was an assistant in the pastry apartment. Of course, we all know her and she moved on. One of the best pastry chefs the city has seen at that level. And that's all I can think of.
And what
was this a long time ago?
Sure.
And what many of those people are still at Union Square Cafe and are still part with Danny Meyer. Of course, Paul Balls Bevan, who just retired. He was a server then, and various other front of the house people who are still within the group.
And what was it like at that time? I mean, had Gramercy opened at that point?
No, Gramercy wasn't open yet. I think Gramercy was not even a dream then. Union Square Cafe was 3 years old at that point, and we just gotten 3 stars.
So this would have been about 88?
Yeah, I think so.
And Danny was on the floor every day?
Danny was always around, yeah, sure.
And what did it feel like in terms of the interaction between front of the house and back of the house at that time?
It wasn't the classic interaction, which was them and us. Back when I was in Switzerland, it was them and us, and we played constant rude tricks on the waiters, and it was a hierarchy. The waiters were just, you know, weren't regarded very highly. But at Union Square Cafe, we were a team, front of the house team, back of the house team. We hung out together. We had a good time. Of course, that was all initiated by Danny and Michael Romano. That we are a team, and as a team, we take care of the customers and not as them and us, and we are better, and you don't know what you're doing, and get the hell out of here.
And what was the menu like? Were there more Italian influences than you had been working with before?
Most definitely. Michael Romano traveled quite a bit, if I remember right, back to Italy, Sardinia. He came back with pasta, malaredus. They're called like little maggot-looking, like city little thingies. It was very much Italian, yeah. But in the New York style, like everything else, is, you know, all tailored towards the New York clientele and their likes and dislikes.
And how did you see that at the time? I mean, how did that fit with your own style?
Well, I didn't have a style at that point, and it was... was awesome to see that you can develop your own style like Michael did. And he worked in Zurich as well. He worked at a restaurant called Shimax, which was a competitor of the restaurant I worked at, Agnes Amberg. So he knew exactly where I came from. And it was good. The first thing he had me do when I did my trail, he gave me a bag of potatoes, and he said, okay, turn those, so make them into beautiful turned potatoes, and I, you know, banged it out in 15-20 minutes, the thing was done. He said, yeah, that doesn't surprise me, because he knew exactly where I came from, and that's what he had to do. I mean, every single vegetable was turned, and from the zucchini, carrots, you know, everything was turned. It was pretty boring. But yeah, he hired me.
And what was he like to work for?
Oh, he was awesome. He was a really good guy. He still is a good guy. He never swore, and, you know, I came from pretty brutal kitchens where clogs would fly through the kitchen, and forks were stuck in your butt just to move faster, and you were verbally abused, although we did have a good time, but just amongst us. The chefs were all alcoholics back there, and working under Michael, it was different because he was a serious chef. He had his own style. He never swore in the kitchen. Of course, he got upset when something didn't work, but there was no verbal abuse. It was all, you know, concentrating on the food and pleasing the customer. That was prime thing to do. And he probably knew, or he knows, that if you upset the kitchen staff, then nothing comes out of him. You know, at Che Max, where he worked there, the chef there was a screamer, was a yeller. And obviously he didn't want to continue that and made a conscious effort to change that in his own kitchen, treat everybody with respect and yeah.
And 88, so you got the 3 stars there. And what was the feeling like in the room and amongst the crew at that time?
Oh, like today. And it was very joyous and we were happy. And, you know, if I remember right, we went out for a beer. And, of course, I didn't know the meaning then because it was my first New York City job. I said, wow, okay, New York Times, 3 stars. That's awesome. But, you know, once you open up your own restaurant, then it's pretty quickly it sinks in what the meaning of a star or 2 or 3 is, and all the money that he invested and all that. So,
and also it was fairly in a unbuilt up neighborhood at that time. I mean, Union Square wasn't known for restaurants so much at that time.
Yeah, that's what I wasn't aware of that. You know, I had a hard time finding Union Square.
You did when first came.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I lived out in Astoria. I don't quite recall how that all came together, but. Yeah, you know, it was a babe in the woods. So,
did you have any like weird encounters, like going to work one day and stepping over dudes or anything? No.
if so, it's not sticking in my memory.
Body outlines in the street? No.
Yeah, no.
So then you moved to a different restaurant group.
After New York, after Union Square Cafe, I was married at the time. We figured we want to move, and we moved to Seattle. So I worked for Westin Hotel. That lasted about a year. I missed the East Coast, and I also wanted to be closer to Switzerland because, you know, flying 6 hours and flying another 9 hours. But on the way back from Seattle to New York, we stopped over in Breckenridge, Colorado. Spent there 1.5 years being a ski bum and trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Came back to New York and worked for Stephen and Thalia Lafredo at Zoe for 4 years as a sous chef under Stephen Levin. And that was quite a culture shock, you know, because that was the free rolling 90s. And Stephen Levin, he pretty much put anything on a plate that was sexy, crazy, cool at that time. Wontons, sesame seeds with gnocchi and knishes and house cured salmon, and was really wild. Yeah.
And they were doing a lot of seasonal ingredients too.
Yeah, we did. But I think the focus was more on being innovative and creative. And I think it was the time when mainstream American cooks started to discover Asian ingredients, you know, so they were all going completely crazy with that stuff, something you wouldn't find today anymore. But we had a good time, and Stephen Levine, he was quite a creative person. I don't know how he ever came up with all that stuff, but he was a good chef in that regards. And we flanked him as sous chefs. That's what sous chefs should do. Protect the chef. You know, you figure out what the chef is good at, and he was very good in the creative part, and us sous chefs took care of the kitchen with the ordering, scheduling, and all that stuff. So,
and this was
that was a great team.
Soho in the 90s.
Tumbleweeds rolling down the streets on Sunday afternoon. It wasn't what it is today. But we also, at the same time, would do incredible numbers, 250 on a Saturday night, crazy brunches, just through the roof, very successful. So I did that for 4 years.
And then Chena opened.
Cena? Well, once again, traveled again. My wife and I took a half a year off and went up to Alaska with our Bronco. Actually, before that, I was a chef in 2 restaurants that went belly up, which was the best experience I ever had on someone else's dime. I don't wish this on anybody. But to go through the experience of having to worry about where to buy the produce and how to make payroll and explain it to your cooks and having dishwashers just walk off the line because you didn't pay him, you couldn't pay him. That was an awesome experience because it laid the foundation for everything that I did then afterwards, treating your employees right and pay him and try to make as much money as he can and try to make everybody else aware of that how important making money actually is, not just because you have to pay rent, but also everybody else is involved here. That was good. The restaurant was called Stingray, 79th and Amsterdam. So that lasted a year or so. And then my wife and I, we said, okay, we had enough. And we traveled up to Alaska with our Bronco and back down to New Orleans and back up to New York. And I started working again for Stephen Othalio Lafredo when they opened up Cena with Norman Lepreys as the chef. He's very successful up in Montreal still, a restaurant called Toke. Awesome chef, one of the best chefs I worked for. Creative, very, very in tune with produce. That was the first time I actually came in contact with a chef or worked for a chef who was so produce-driven. And the produce up in Montreal is just absolutely awesome. It's, we have miles to go before we beat them. I worked up there for a month or 6 weeks or so before we opened up Cena. And we had different mushroom guys come by. We would go out to the farm and look at vegetables. They would come by with all their goods, venison farms or elk farms, mushroom farms. So he showed me all that stuff. But really awesome, awesome, awesome. And the seasons are, one would think that it's pretty cold up there, which I suspect it is. But the growing seasons, they really try to make the most out of it.
So you come and do Cena, and okay. What was that experience like?
It was an extremely stressful experience. Norman Lepreys will come down from Montreal every 3 weeks. Prior to that, I would get recipes and ingredients list and would have to have everything ready. He will come down right from the airport, right into the kitchen. We would start prepping. I tried to get as much done as possible while running. I was the chef de cuisine while running the operation. So he would come down, would prep out everything. Then on day one, we would prep. Day two, we would start doing tastings for the owners. Day three, tweaking. Day four, implementing. Day five, explaining it to the staff. Day six, a little bit more fine-tuning. And day seven, he would be off again. And we did that 12 times, you know, every 4 weeks. It was really hard. Like I said, while at the same time taking care of the front part, which was the cafe and the dining room and all the expectations. We got 3 stars. I don't recall who the reviewer was, but we got 3 stars from the New York Times right out of the box. It was pretty good. But somehow it didn't work out for the owners, and we had to close after a year, which was extremely depressing. You know, at that point, I cooked for 25 years already, and it was pretty depressing. We were all down, and when they set me down and said, okay, you know, we cannot continue, we spend too much money, or too many people asking for money, and they might pick up the ice machine tomorrow. I said, well, God, you know, I'm going to go through that again. But they pulled the plug and sold the place, and at that point I figured, okay, what else can I do besides cooking and going through that again? I knocked on the doors down at the Chelsea Winewald and Chelsea Market. Started first as a part-time salesperson. If you know me, nobody wants to buy anything from me. They just don't trust me like I sell them some lemon or something. But then somehow I talked them into making me the wine buyer. I don't know if that was the smartest move they ever did, but that was the start of my wine buying career. And simultaneously, or shortly after that, I started to make the correlation between food and wine and how it actually all fit together. like sake and Japanese food, Western food, French food, and wine. It just like sort of clicked. After having been a buyer for 2 years, I talked to my wife and started to rope in investors and start looking for space. And ultimately, we found Treslan 10th, which at that time it was still Chelsea Commons, a run-down neighborhood bar, pretty skanky place. I thought I could just fix it up, so make like a little gastro pop out of it, a term that was still used then. But that didn't work out because everything we touched just fell apart. So
originally the idea was that you and Juliet Pope, who is the wine director at Gramercy and also your wife, were going to open the restaurant together, Trestle. And
yeah.
How did that all really work out in reality?
It didn't work out that well. While writing the business plan and securing investment and all that, I was in high hopes and didn't see it that she had not much of interest in joining me. Which in hindsight, of course, is a smart thing. That's women are very smart in that sort of department. They sense when things don't go the way it's supposed to go or the way you wish it should go. Then she broke my heart and she pulled out and she said, no, I want to stay at Gramercy Tavern where her true love is. But she would support me whichever way was necessary. Like I said, she broke my heart, but for a good thing. And I'm glad that she did. Because I don't think we could work together. Too strong of characters and too much of opinions how things should be going. Although I think we would be an awesome power team, and I do offer her once in a while, hey, if you ever want to open up your own restaurant, I run it for you. You're the boss, and I just do what you say, but she hasn't signed up yet. So I was on my own, for all the support, of course, and it took us a long time to renovate Treslan 10th, or what then became Treslan 10th. It's pretty much a lemon. We had to excavate downstairs, go 2 feet down into the ground. We found groundwater that was a living hell. The ceiling in the dining room, once we pulled that thing down, we found rotten, broken, split beams. Part of the front was all rotten out, and one of the apartments was about to fall on our heads. It was really a lot of work, but thanks to the investors who were committed and showed their commitment by supporting us, they just shoveled more money into it, and we ended up with a fantastic, beautiful restaurant. Had a great architect, Joseph Preeny, who is more of a residential architect, and it shows, but great, great guy, and pretty much worked pro bono because he was there day and night. Helping me renovate that place.
And it seems like now that it's open, the neighborhood also supports it quite strongly.
Quite a bit, yeah. The neighborhood and also people from far away. We started off as a neighborhood restaurant, and I think we grew somewhat out of that. We are always welcome. We always welcome, of course, neighborhood people. That's where we are. But at the same time, we grew, and we are much more successful than we ever were. The High Line helps, of course, and the galleries in conjunction, combining the two, we are busy.
And did you open before the High Line really got going?
The High Line was perhaps a dream. At that point, we didn't know about it. We knew it was there, and we followed the story that Bloomberg?
I think Bloomberg.
Bloomberg, yeah.
I was associated with David Bowie. Like, because I think he did a lot of community rallying.
Yeah, we just read in a paper that they secured the funds and they bought it from the government for a buck. They still didn't know what to do with it and almost tore it down. And then they secured funds to renovate the High Line and started. We still at that point didn't know what it's going to be, but it was a good thing, and it's a great thing for the neighborhood and 10th Avenue, and it's awesome.
And so people come from other neighborhoods to go on the High Line, which is an elevated park, basically,
right,
on old railroad elevated tracks.
Not just other neighborhoods, also other countries. I mean, we have lots of foreign tourists here who come because of the galleries. We have over 250 galleries in the neighborhood. Some of them world best, Gagosian, for example, and the Highline, which between the two of them brings lots of people into the neighborhood. When we renovated Trestle 7 years ago, Sunday afternoons, Saturday evening, when nobody was on the street, it was not a place you were able to, well, wished to walk around. That all changed. I mean, it's now pretty buzzy. You can get pretty lonely, though, on a snowy or cold, rainy night. It's still 10th Avenue. But overall, it's quite busier.
Well, every time I go in, there's always some gallery people hanging out there at the bar. I mean, you know, you can always tell the art gallery guys like a mile away because they have nice scarves, even in weather where they don't need scarves. You know what I mean?
So. Yeah, they're quite supportive of Trestle on 10th. And, of course, also the other restaurants, Red Cat, Patina. They're quite supportive, and we love them, of course.
It's kind of like a restaurant row, that street.
Yeah, there's still lots of empty space in between. There's a gasoline station right across, and the further up in 10th Avenue you go towards Hell's Kitchen, it becomes a little desolate, but that's also changing fairly quickly with new high-rises, new buildings, and more people, more baby strollers.
So speaking about the neighborhood, what was the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy like?
It's not really talked about that much. After Sandy, there were people with much bigger problems than we had, losing their homes to fire or floods or just devastation. So our problems were pretty small in comparison. I think that the galleries didn't want to up the story because there were so many people suffering, but it was pretty devastating. The many galleries, the ground level galleries, of course, with basements full of art books and archives and paperwork and all that stuff was all lost because those basements just filled up like bathtubs. And lots of art was lost. Some of them were able to renovate their art. But it did a number. And I was worried that the same thing would happen to Chelsea as did to Soho after 9/11 and Tribeca. That is just desolate. You know, it's going to take a decade to pick up again. But that didn't happen. I don't want to say it was touch and go, but we really didn't know where we were at for a couple months after Sandy. But pretty quickly after that, we figured out, hey, nobody's talking about it. And it's, you know, everybody's cleaning up. Everybody is pulling through this with all the support that the galleries have and all the other restaurants pulled together, and we just kept on marching on. And now it feels like it never happened, but we're still dealing with the insurance, and that's not easy. We had a trestle, we had 2 feet of water down in the basement, which wasn't pretty water. It was pretty nasty water. It's not like, you know, beautiful, clean river water. Far from it, and we had tremendous damage. All computers, micros, everything was gone, ovens, refrigeration. Of course, we had no electricity for 5 days, 4.5 days. So everything in a walk-in, all pickled things, pickled cherries, rams, everything, cheeses, everything. We must have filled up 20 black bags, if not more, of just produce out of the walk-in, and everything went in the garbage. It was a great opportunity to deep clean the restaurant, without a doubt. It took us 2 days, but it wasn't necessary.
And you are the chef owner, but you do the wine.
Yeah.
And I always found it one of the more distinctive and interesting lists in New York.
Well, thank you.
Certainly in Manhattan. And what is your approach to a small list that you have nonetheless made exciting?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, right when Trestle on 10th opened up, or before Trestle on 10th opened up, I had to find a focus for the wine list, and I decided to make it all cool climate wines around Switzerland, so Germany, Austria, Italy, France, and then the regions, Alto Adige and all that. And of course, Swiss wines, although they're pretty expensive, and well, that's another story for another day. And also American wines from cooler climates. And so that in itself already limited quite a bit of what I was able to buy and taste. But much more important for me when I put the wine list together and also what, the way I still buy is I want to find a meaning in a wine. I want to find soul. I want to find emotions. Of course, that sounds all very hypothetical and a little brainy, crazy, kooky talk, but it's important for me. I cannot deal or don't want to deal with a wine that doesn't have a soul, that doesn't have a story to tell. And usually I get the stories by meeting the winemaker or whoever makes the wine or the owner or whatever. So if I see dirt underneath beneath their fingernails or calloused, honest hands, then I know this is going to be an awesome wine. I might not like it stylistically, or perhaps it's a faulty wine or what I perceive as faulty wine. But at least I know that the hands who made that wine had good intentions and tried to do something honest. That's the criteria that I like to buy wine with.
Did you find that that approach actually helped with just time management? Because you're like, you know what? I don't even need to try these wines because that's just not what I'm into. So
oh, absolutely.
I'm going to focus in on these that I'm going to spend the time that I have, because you are also the chef.
Right.
That you have a lot of things to do.
Right.
So it feels like you structured a list that you could also handle, like in terms of time.
Yes, yes. Once in a while I dream about a wine list that's twice as big. But then besides storage, it's like, you know, can I spend more time on a list? And the answer is yes. If you take me out of the kitchen or the operation, then I can spend more time on a wine list. And I think I find a good balance between the three, running the restaurant, being the owner, taking care of my staff and the customers, of course, and the kitchen and many changes, although I wish I could do more of those. But time seems to be running away, or priorities, and dealing with the wine list. So I have a full plate, but I have an awesome staff who's really supportive, from the dishwashers to the cooks, to the front of the house, to the waiters, management. They all support me and Tressel on 10th to make it a successful restaurant best way they can.
So when you evaluate a wine, do you feel like that personal connection that you make with the grower or winemaker can be tasted in a finished product?
Well, it sounds a little goofy if I would say yes, but I think that something comes through in the wine if the wine is made with soul. So I believe that the up and down of a winemaker you can taste in a wine. And like I said, it sounds all a little goofy, but if a winemaker really has a splendid year and he's really happy with the grapes and he's happy with his life and he's happy with the rainfall and the sunshine and everything, that comes through in the wine. Equally, if the winemaker goes through a dark patch of his wine, of his life, then I think that you taste that as well. It doesn't mean it's a bad thing, but that's where I think you get character out of the wine, and it's not just a manufactured, you know, 60,000 gallon stainless steel container made wine. But whenever you create something, you pass it on. If it's now with food, you give a little bit of yourself. If you write a script for a movie, if you write a book, if you create, I use that term, create food loosely, because everything has been done already, at least once. But if you come up with new food, new combinations, if you make wine, you give a little bit of yourself. You shed a part of your soul. That can be very rewarding. That can also be extremely hurtful, because you give. Okay, if nothing comes back, it's hurtful. If you're getting trashed, it's hurtful. Same thing for a winemaker. They give something.
And are there wines that were a little bit lesser known when you were putting them on the list and starting to work with them that have gotten a little bit more traction, at least in your restaurant?
Yes, without a doubt, there are wines that are being sold now and you find on lists that weren't around or weren't thought after. You know, look at Jura wines. You know, they were always great. Pouffigny was already a great producer 15 years ago. or Ganevad, you know, they used to come in, and the wines used to come in two phases of Ganevad, and now you have eight different Ganevads come in, or eight different phases, and unobtainable. You cannot buy them anymore unless you're a rich restaurant and have rich clientele. So yeah, a few years ago, nobody talked about those, and today they are successful and they're hip wines.
Do you think your time as a buyer at the wine shop gave you a point of view for developing your own list?
Without a doubt. If I never have to sell another bottle of Ruf Clicquot, I'm going to be happy. Of course, there's a market for that, and the people love it, but I'm not enamored by it. And it gave me a foundation to figure out what I like and what I don't like, and what I would like to support, which is a very important point. And other wines that don't need my support, they don't need my help. And having just said that, I think that's another aspect of my wine list. I think there are wines that need to be drunk, need to be heard, and the story that needs to be told through wines that we'd like to support.
And have you found that placing a certain format of list has helped get that message across sometimes? I feel like you've used little symbols and things to indicate to your customers what they might
yeah,
be for.
Yeah, we have... Now, first of all, we have a star system for sweeter wines or perceived sweetness, so mainly Rieslings and some sweeter Shura wines, where it's 1 to 3, 1 being fairly dry and 3 being cloyingly sweet, which we don't have. And then we have another symbol, which is skull and crossbones, and that's more a warning and also help for the waiters, but a warning for the customers that, A, if you have to ask what it means, there's a little description, which means all traditional wines, and we can debate what all that means, but if you're a customer and sort of have to ask what it means, then with our help, we can guide you through the wine and we can explain you what it means, but there's a good chance you're not going to like the wine right off the bat because there might be a little oxidized, there might be a little orange, there might be just a little funky, it might be a sans souffre wine. So tread with caution here, but we're more than happy to help you along.
Have you found that skull and crossbones has actually increased interest in a certain consumer? Like people are like, whoa, they say other people can't handle it, give me some.
I don't think so. I think it scares people off, which... That doesn't sound like a selling technique here, but if it scares people off, then at least they're not going to have a bad experience with their wine. For example, Sauvignon Blanc are right above Sauvignon, Savonnet. Okay? And we had in the past, before we put the skull and crossbone on, that people would choose Savonnet because it's right next to Sauvignon Blanc. And then, of course, they would be very much disappointed. Today, the wine has a skull and crossbone, and they're sort of like a little warned.
They don't send it back.
They don't send it back, and they don't think that we serve bad wine, and we don't know what we're doing, which, you know, is debatable, of course, but at least you've been warned that this is a little bit out of the extraordinary.
And you carry those wines because you feel that, one, you like them, and two, they go well with your food.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That's another philosophy is... Or a point to look at is if you compare the food of a region with the wine of the same region, they always go together. Okay, it just works out. You can't go wrong. So in Jura, there's a reason why they have these wines, the high acid, zippy, vervy, electricity wine, because the food is a little heavier, gets pretty cold in winter. So there's a reason for that, and you find that throughout the regions, yeah.
And how has the style of what you're making in terms of food clarified over the years that you've run the restaurant? Has it changed a little bit, or has your perspective changed?
Well, it always has to evolve in every restaurant. Every cuisine needs to evolve with customer demands. So, like I said, we have lots of gallery goers. We have lots of what we call luncheon ladies, they probably will not deal very well with a blood sausage at lunch. Okay, so it's just not going to fly. But perhaps we can do it in January, in the deep of winter, what we call Metzgete. We announce that and we sell it. That's fantastic. So we always have to evolve with the customers, and we have to evolve ourselves and grow.
Because you have done dinners around a certain kind of food. Like you've sent out emails in advance and said, hey, we're going to do a special kind of traditional food menu.
For right, especially the Metzgete, which we do every January, second week. In the dead of winter, we try to utilize pigs and do the most of it, which is a very traditional thing in Switzerland. So we serve, it's almost like a choucroute garni, but very Swiss, with blood sausage, liver sausage, bratwurst, sauerkraut, mashed potato, roasted pig ears, pork belly, and it all comes on one giant platter, something that you only can do once a year. And you should, you know, you don't want to have it every night for dinner. It would be big as a house. But that's something that people used to eat.
Something with necks too, right?
We have duck necks on.
Duck necks.
Which is, they're confit and breaded and fried in a pan and served with a rosemary aioli.
And not too long ago, you opened up another restaurant nearby called Rocket Pig.
It's a sandwich takeout shop. It's very successful. Got lots of positive reviews and opinions. And that's a great project. And might be a project that we're going to pursue and see what we can do with it, because I think we have something there.
How did that get started?
By pure chance, right across the garden of Dresselland 10th, there was a dilapidated old building, an old horse stable or cow stable or something like that. And the landlord decided to tear it down and rebuild it and offered us the space. We didn't know what to do with the space. We just knew we want to have it. And it's too small for a bar, too small for a private dining room. We don't need more seats. The kitchen is already too small for what we have almost. So I figured, well, let's make it a takeout shop, and then sort of like distilled from there one sandwich, which became then the Rocket Pig sandwich.
And how did you decide on pig?
Well, I grew up with pigs. I mean, not. I grew up eating pig. That's pretty much all you eat in Switzerland. We had maybe once a year, my family was able to afford beef roast or veal, very seldom. It's just, you know, we weren't able to afford that. My dad was a game warden, so we had lots of game. But besides that, it was all pig. So I grew up with slaughtering pigs. We had a pig every year that was broken down. The pig would come like Saturday morning. It would come to a quick end with a bolt through the brain and then scalded, so to scratch off the bristles. Hung up and gutted, and the blood would let go, so blood sausages, and then hung up and gutted and cut into different prime cuts, and then made into sausage and bacon and all sort of stuff. In the olden days, which at my age, I think there's already an olden age, there was a guy which is a traveling butcher. He would go from farmhouse to farmhouse and break down pigs and manufacture the pigs. Then at the end of the day, he would leave and the whole pig would be in pieces and in the freezer and in sausages and all that. So that would happen at least once a year or twice a year. And sometimes we would share the pig with other neighbors, because, you know, I moved away then, so the pig would be too much for just my mom, my dad.
I feel like through ups and downs, you've managed to achieve what your family wanted for you, which was to never go hungry.
I guess, yes. It's absolutely true, but didn't foresee, you know, what it all means to be a cook. Because that's what you start off with, and it's a very hard job. I don't envy any of my line cooks. It's brutal behind the stove, you know, day in, day out, 12 hours, 13 hours, other restaurants even more, 5 days a week. You walk around like a zombie. You're pasty white, you drink too much, smoke too much when we still smoked. And just do it every day, every day, every day. You have 1 day off or 2 days off, and it's grueling. Nobody told you that. Nobody told you that you're not going to have any friends except your your fellow cooks. Nobody told you that you don't have a life. So it's hard, but it's also rewarding. You're making customers happy. And now at my stage, owning a restaurant, owning Rocket Pig, and being in the wine world, it's very rewarding. I'm very grateful for everything that happened to me and continue to happen to me and others as well.
Ralph Gudel of Trestle on 10th and Rocket Pig, thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Great talking with you. Hey, gang. So you know our show here is sponsored by the wonderful 750, which is a search and find pricing database for wholesale buyers in New York and New Jersey, which we love very much. But we found a few other people who love it, too, one of whom is the fabulous Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, who's here today.
Hey, guys. So I buy for a lot of different random wines, and I love to use 750 because there's a lot of great smaller wholesalers on there that you can take a look at. And as Garth Algar would say from Wayne's World, live in the now. Use 750 because it's great. And it's wonderful for those liquor buyers and wine buyers out there.
Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, a user of the 750 service. Thank you. All Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe, alldrinktothatpod.com, or on Twitter at drinktothatpod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.